Good morning. For people living in nursing homes and residential care settings and those who love them, it was a difficult and fearful week. Yesterday's figures show that more than 300 of the 486 deaths from COVID-19 in this country so far have occurred in such settings. On Tuesday's Liveline, Dorothy Duffy read a poem in memory of her sister Rose Mitchell, who had died in a nursing home of COVID-19.
My sister is not a statistic. Tomorrow, when the latest deathometer of COVID is announced in sonorous tones, while all the time the bodies still mount and curl towards the middle of the curve, heaped one atop and alongside the other, my sister will be among those numbers. Among the throwaway line, among the platitudes and lowered eyes, an older person with underlying health conditions. A pitiful way to lay rest the bare bones of a life. My sister is not a statistic. Her underlying conditions were love, kindness, belief in the essential goodness of mankind, uproarious laughter, forgiveness, compassion, a storyteller, a survivor, a comforter, a force of nature, and so much more. My sister is not a statistic. She died without the soft touch of a loved one's hand, without a feathered kiss upon her forehead, without the muted murmur of familiar family voices gathered round her bed, without the gentle roar of laughter that comes with memories recalled, evoked from a time that already seems distant, when we were connected by the simplicity of touch, of voice, of presence. My sister is not a statistic. She was a woman who spanned the seven ages, a mother, a grandmother, a great-grandmother, a sister, a friend, an aunt, a carer, a giver. My sister is not a statistic.
Dorothy Duffy reading a poem about her sister Rose Mitchell on Tuesday's Liveline. On Morning Ireland yesterday, Rachel English spoke to Minister Simon Harris.
Minister, the figures showing again this morning that more than half of all deaths here are connected to nursing homes, another 50 or so we know connected to other residential centres. What went wrong?
Well, good morning, Rachel. I think what we're seeing here is that we're making very good progress as a country, but that we need to really redouble our efforts in relation to residential settings. And sadly, we know that this vicious, dangerous virus is having a particularly devastating impact on older people, and particularly older people with underlying conditions. A huge amount has been done to support our residential settings, and I can go through that if you wish, but there is clearly a need to do an awful lot more. And today, I came off a very lengthy teleconference with HICWA last night, the HSE, the department, the chief medical officer. And today we're going to see a number of more measures taken, particularly an increase in extra testing in our residential settings. I've heard from leading doctors that as they learn more about this virus now, they're seeing that some of the common symptoms, like a cough and a fever that would be present in most of us if we had COVID-19, are not necessarily being present in everybody in a residential setting who may have COVID-19. So we need to start testing now asymptomatic people, people without symptoms. And the HSE today will start using the National Ambulance Service to carry out more tests. But look, there's absolutely no doubt this. We need to do more in relation to our residential settings. But equally, I think we also need to acknowledge that we've made a lot of progress as a country, not thanks to government or anybody else, but thanks to the Irish people's sacrifices and the strategy and the plan that they're following.
Minister Simon Harris on Morning Ireland yesterday. Now, we are still in it, clearly. But maybe, just maybe, there might be an end in sight. Let's talk reproduction with environment and science correspondent George Lee.
It's called the reproduction rate of the virus. And what it means is that if a person had the virus originally, before anything was ever done and any mitigation was taken or any social distancing, it's estimated that the reproduction rate was of the order of 4.3. That meant if you had it and you were walking around, you would pass it on to 4.3 people on average. Every single one of them would then pass it on to 4.3 people on average. And those 4.3 each pass it on again. And so it grows exponentially. That's the reproduction rate. That was the frightening thing thing. That's what people were afraid of. You know, you'd have this huge spike, a huge surge in cases, and it would take off and destroy our health system and so on. So the issue was, how do you slow this down? And so the first thing they did was they closed the schools. That brought the reproduction rate down from about 4.3, they were saying last week, to 2.7, but I have a funny feeling they're going to say it was about 2.4 today. It meant that instead of reinfecting 4.7, you infected 2.7 or 2.4. And I think it is really significant. We knew last week that they thought it was coming down close to one, and that was after all of the social distancing and all of the measures that we brought in where people couldn't go to work and so on, and people over a certain age were asked to cocoon, and they knew it was coming down to one. The big thing was to get it down below one. If it's 1.2, it means it's your infection rate is continuing to grow in the community, and over a period of time you would still have too many cases for the health service. Getting it below one means that you're infecting less than one person if you contract this disease. It means that if you keep it like that, it will nearly dwindle and die out itself over a period of time. Where are we going to get there? Well, it certainly appears that we have got there at this point, because what the minister said in the Dáil was that he knows that various calculations have been done, and there are four methods of calculations they use to test this, and each one is showing a calculation of a reproduction either from 0.7 to 1, below 1. And that is like the holy grail in terms of trying to contain a virus. That's a huge achievement, and I think it's going to save an awful lot of misery.
It is indeed.
George Lee on Drive Time on Thursday, dear, we hope. Well, on Tuesday, Seán O'Rourke spoke to Dr. David Nabarro, World Health Organization's special envoy on COVID-19.
Realistically, how long do you think it's going to be before people in this country or the UK can look forward to going back to race meetings, football matches, where there are large crowds congregating?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. And I do understand that for everybody, these are the kind of questions they desperately want answers to. We do know that when people congregate together, even in small gatherings, it provides an opportunity for this virus to move quickly from person to person. And individuals can get really sick, and unfortunately, they can die. What I think we will have to work out as a society is how we can do these big gatherings like race meetings or football matches without at the same time exposing ourselves to a lot of risk. And perhaps the most important thing that I'm going to have to say now is that a lot depends on our own responsibility. Are we prepared when we're feeling unwell, when we've got a fever, when we've got a cough, to say to our mates, I'm sorry, I can't come to the football match or I can't come to the races because I think I might have the COVID. I've got to stay at home and I've got to isolate. It's that kind of responsibility that we've got to be able to show each other collectively. That's what's going to enable us to be able to start doing things together and doing it without the fear that somebody is going to accidentally give us the virus.
Dr. David Nabarro of the World Health Organization on the need for social distancing, a view shared by Agaritza Bacca of the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control. But what was her view on the wearing of masks?
Yeah, and about masks, I mean, the ECDC was saying last week that we should consider wearing them in social spaces. Now, do you think that we will be wearing them in everyday life in the foreseeable future, and perhaps for the foreseeable future?
I think this recommendation will stay, yes, that we should consider it, because we said it very carefully that this is to protect others. This is not to protect yourself.
Yes.
This is to protect others because you may be an asymptomatic person ill with COVID and you don't know that.
And do you mind me asking you a personal question? Do you wear a mask yourself in everyday life at the supermarket, for example?
Here in Sweden, I live in Sweden, of course, since we are... So here in Sweden, as you know, they've been extremely... let's say they followed a more open...
light touch, I think, might be the word.
Approach, yes. So what I try to do, actually, is I usually go very late, so there aren't many people, and so I don't wear it.
Yeah.
Because there are very, very few people. I try to do social distance more than wear a mask.
Oh, that took a while to get a straight answer, didn't it? That was Agaritza Bacca of the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control. But back to Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO. What likelihood do we have of getting a vaccine?
I don't know when this vaccine is going to come. I'm really levelling with you and your listeners here. the coronaviruses are not easy viruses to work with. They're really nasty in the way they cause disease, and they tend to stick around and go on causing disease. And they're not kind of nice candidates for vaccines like influenza viruses. And so I hear reports that scientists believe that they've got a vaccine. But what I want to see is when that vaccine has been shown to be effective in really offering protection, when that vaccine has shown to be safe in not causing people to get other illnesses and perhaps have even more problems, when that vaccine can be produced in large quantities at low cost, when that vaccine is available for distributing all over the world, then I'll say, yeah, we've got the solution. But we don't know when that's going to come. And also, we've got some horrible other questions, which we're dealing with, but they're like this. If you've had COVID, are you likely to get again, yes or no? And there's uncertainties about whether or not the body itself develops immunity against the virus so it doesn't come again. All these have to be worked out. So I think that as societies, we're going to have to learn to find ways to go about our normal business as much as we can with the virus as a continuing threat. Otherwise, we'll be paralyzed. And that's why I say it's up to us as people to find ways to do it. It's up to us as people to learn the codes of behavior we have to adopt with the virus in our midst.
Of course, if a vaccine were to be developed, a heck of a lot of us wouldn't actually avail of it. So we learned from a major new survey published this week that looked at the effect of COVID-19 on our mental health, how we're responding, understanding and coping with the pandemic. Here's Dr. Philip Hyland, Associate Professor of Psychology at Maynooth University and one of the researchers behind the survey.
We asked people, if a vaccine were developed, would you take it for yourself? 65% of people said yes. 26% of people said maybe, and 9% of people said no. So ultimately, we have 35% of people in the population who are not saying yes to accepting a vaccine for this virus if it were developed. So our goal in this survey is really to identify who these people are who are saying maybe and who are saying no. We want to get a sense of what's going on inside their minds, what's motivating them to not say yes. We want to find out, where do they get their information from? You know, is it newspapers, TV, the internet? We're asking them about who do they trust in society? What information would they need in order to say yes? And all of this is to help us build some means of communication so we can go out, we can tailor a message to these people who are not saying yes and deliver it in the right way from the right people.
Yes, but you've got something like 90% of the people saying either they will or they will maybe take or accept a vaccine. That's not a bad base for an authority, a health authority, to build on, given the uncertainty that there is about the availability. And people might be a bit wary about whether it's going to be properly tested. They don't want to be taking something that's done in a rush.
Absolutely. So the group that we're probably most interested in are these 26% of people who are saying maybe. If those 26% of people who are saying maybe can be shifted rather easily over to the yes category, then we're in a great state. However, if those 26% of people are more inclined to say no, then we're in a very difficult position. So that's what we need to answer, and that's what we're working on right now.
Dr. Philip Hyland with Sean on Thursday. But let's finish by going back to yesterday's interview with Minister Simon Harris on Morning Ireland and tentative baby steps to an end.
The lifting of restrictions is going to be complex, it's going to be delicate, and there is going to be a degree of trial and error. Now, we will be grounded in everything we do by public health advice, because what's very, very clear from the model is if you just lifted the restrictions, this curve would shoot right back up. And we're not going to do that. We are not going to erase the progress that the Irish people have made, and we're not going to put people's lives and the lives of their families at risk. What I would like to be able to do, though, and we'd all like to be able to do, because we all have a physical health, a mental health, families that we're missing, lives that we're missing, our support structures gone, we would like to be able to put in place a plan to see a gradual easing of some of the restrictions. But I have to be blunt and honest with people, as I've been throughout this. That is going to not involve going back to life as we knew it in the short term. It is going to involve social distancing, keeping our physical distance and keeping all of those public health measures in place for a period of time while seeing if there's things that we can't do today that we could do again in a few weeks. It's a very delicate balance. It will be led by Dr. Tony Houlihan, who's led us through this from the start. It will be grounded in public health. And I want the people of Ireland to know that public health is going to be priority 1, 2, and 3 in that regard.
And when you say, you mention a few weeks, I mean, do you hope that there can be some easing of restrictions, no matter how small, after the 5th of May?
I really do.
Ooh, let's hope so. And in the meantime,
wash your hands.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. The drama on One this week was The Curse of the Button Accordion by Sharon Mannion.
Well, you like football. What about that?
I'm too short.
Running.
Too slow.
Knitting.
Too thummy. She gives up. She knows as well as I do that I'm boring and useless at everything. I spend my evenings after school wandering around the house, opening and closing drawers, making sure to not touch the good scissors and to make no noise while the news is on. There's an old tin whistle that lives in the drawer beneath the window. It's nestled between old rolls of camera film and 17 hairbrushes. The day after my 11th birthday, Mam obviously feels I've matured somewhat, because when I take it out to look at it, she says she'll show me how to play.
Come on, love, watch me here.
I stare intently at her fingers as she plays a jig before passing it to me.
Play that again, Sharon. Sean!
Oh my God! I'm good at this! I don't even need notes. I can play by ear. A tune comes on the radio. I have it down in under 6 minutes. Mam wheels me out whenever an aunt or uncle comes within a 5 mile radius of the house.
Bring out Sharon. She can play anything.
Neighbours that I've barely met become my biggest fans.
Sharon, you're fabulous. I wish mine were more like you. Mad into the books they are. They'll end up as librarians or scientists. But not you, Sharon. No way. With fingers like that, the world is your oyster.
My parents are thrilled. I found my talent. Dad in particular gets a kick out of it.
Oh, I see you're playing that thing now.
He's so impressed. I'm high on the attention. I haven't thought about the end of the world in 4 days. I play the tin whistle everywhere I go. I even perform in shows. Old folks' Christmas functions, the Good Friday celebrations at Mass, you name it, I play it. I can't believe my luck. This tube of metal has changed my life. Everywhere I go, people think I'm great. Genetics haven't failed me. I have found my saxophone. I can't shake this funny feeling in my tummy. I think it's self-esteem.
The Curse of the Button Accordion by Sharon Mannion, the drama on One this week. And Tubes of Metal brings us nicely to RTE Concert Orchestra oboe player David Agnew, who came into Sean O'Rourke to talk about learning to play and teaching scales and arpeggios to, well, less than musical pupils.
Now, how do you come off that and maybe have to deal with the drudgery of teaching somebody who you know just isn't going to make it? I mean, they're in hurling towers, they'd be a bit of a mullocker.
you help people realise their potential, and whatever that potential is, there is some achievement in that. I think there's great joy in effort. I think people who make the effort, people who try, and if they realise whatever their potential is, even if it's only playing 3 or 4 notes on a piano, and even if it's sharing a song or a verse with somebody that they're close to or living with, that's where it's all at.
What if a situation arises where the student isn't willing, but the parent has plenty of money?
Well, no, I mean, I was one of those myself. I was forced to learn the piano. When I was 5, brought into lessons, and I hated it for years. I mean, even John O'Connor tried to teach me.
John?
Yeah, God love him. He was still a student before he went away to...
Vienna, I think it was.
To Vienna, and won the Beethoven Prize. And he took me for a walk down Grafton Street one day, and he just said, look, David, this isn't working out, you know. But, you know, I took up guitar at 9, I did recorder at 7, and... I really wanted to be a rock guitarist, and I used to go and see Gary Moore and Rory Gallagher live. Mm-hmm. That was really where I was at. And my parents still insisted that I do the piano up as far as the Leaving Cert. And I'm eternally grateful to them for keeping me at it.
oboe player David Agnew, so never too late to take up an instrument. Or maybe you could do like author Liz Nugent. She joined Rhine to talk about publishing yet another bestseller, Our Little Cruelties, well worth a read. But having been in hospital for a spell, she also let slip that, well, she's taken up an old habit again.
I'm doing the worst thing. I'm smoking.
Are you? You're back.
Yes, I'm back smoking. It's the most ridiculous thing. But when I was in the Royal Hospital in Donnybrook, I used to have a cigarette when I had a drink, you know, and only then. But when I was in the Royal Hospital in Donnybrook, the occupational therapist came to me one day, and because I had ticked the form that said I smoked and I drank occasionally, she said, you know, I have to bring you outside for a cigarette. And I said, sorry?
And she said, hospital.
Yes. And she said, well, for health and safety reasons, we have to make sure that you can light the cigarette, smoke it and extinguish it without setting fire to yourself. So I have to bring you out. So we went out. She wheeled me out in a wheelchair out of this freezing cold shed. And I had a cigarette. And then it became a habit because I just thought, well, at least I'm getting out of the hospital room. So I used to wheel myself out every night and have three cigarettes in a row. And now I am smoking without drinking because I can't drink because of the medication I'm on. So I've gone from being a drinking smoker to pretty much an all-day smoker, which is just the worst thing at this time.
It is.
I have to cut it out. I have to just stop.
It will stop. I have no doubt about it. There's a lot of love coming in.
Liz Nugent with Ryan. Spring Light was the title of a special programme by Michael Harding, recorded in his home on the Leitrim-Roscommon border.
I don't think anybody expected the virus. Like, it must be so tiny. A little germ, a little bacteria. A little dot of a thing that you couldn't even see with a microscope. And yet it has enough complexity on it to upend the entire human species. I mean, when that happens, you have to admit there's some conversation going on between us and the cosmos. Like, it's trying to tell us something. And I don't know what it is trying to tell us. But all I do know is that it's very quiet. There's no traffic on the roads. There's nobody going up and down the road with tractors or vans. And there's no planes in the sky. The world was never this quiet in my entire life. Even in the empty churches and the cloisters of my youth, where I first learned to pray as a Christian boy child, there was never anything like this quiet. I mean, the first 2 weeks were the worst. They were really bad. I was shocked. I was frightened. Took me a little while to adapt to the new situation, even though I've been half isolated for years. Sometimes I woke in the middle of the night and I'd scan the newspapers on my phone for fresh catastrophes. And then I'd say to myself, this is not right. It's 3 a.m. I'm going to the toilet. I shouldn't be reading the newspaper at 3 a.m. to see what else has gone wrong with the world. But that's the way it goes. You start expecting worse and worse and worse. I'd go back to bed and I'd lie and say to myself, it's a new world. I must adapt.
And with this adaptation was also new life, fresh growth and the light of spring.
And the wonder of life, when you see the sun shining on a lake or a mountain glistening in the evening, the one thing that you kind of feel strongly is this will go on no matter what. We used to think in terms of a little light, a little candle shining in the darkness, and the darkness being vast and enormous. But the way I can make sense to myself of the virus is because it is springtime, because we are being called into the summer, I feel like the thing I take consolation in is the sun itself, the light itself. The more beautiful and intense and brightly everything glistens as it grows. And that, to me, is clear. My candle now is the sun, and it flickers. It flickers powerfully, wonderfully. And I turn to it, embrace it. I walk out into the garden with no plan except to accept this day, this moment, this beautiful, beautiful springtime.
Michael Harding from the programme Spring Light. In the Darcy household, meanwhile, this happened.
Well, 14 days. I fed it, I watched it, minded it like a baby, treated it like a loved one.
He speaks, of course, of the sourdough starter.
Sunday, I set 7 hours aside. I kid you not, 7 hours. After 2 weeks of feeding this feckin' thing, and then it takes 7 hours because you have to proof it. Now, I thought I was saying proofing wrong, but you can say proving or proofing. It's either or. And that's where you make your dough and you let it sit. And when I made it, it looked fine, and it nice little bun-shaped thing, and I let it proof. Didn't rise too much, but the man in the BBC recipe said, don't expect it to rise too much. And then I did a little bit of knocking it back. I didn't know that existed either. You knock back your dough, and that's not drinking it, you knock it back. So when I saw that in the recipe, I put knock back into the Google machine, and this lady came up, this wonderfully English lady with a not wonderfully English name, Titli Nihan. And she has a YouTube channel, and she spoke to me about knocking back my dough.
Now, the first thing to do with the dough after the first rising is to knock it back.
There you go.
And what we're doing here is we're punching all the gas out of the dough.
She was really going
at it. This will help us to shape
like Katie Taylor or Kelly Harrington. Going at it.
Just
knocking it back.
My dough up.
I suspect she imagined somebody who had done her a wrong in the past. And she was hitting the dough. Knocking it back.
Bread for the final proving, the final rising.
Proving, she
The
says.
Principle is that we want the gluten stretched into a nice tall...
Now, you don't need to know all that, because you're bored already listening to me talk about my sourdough starter. But Titli is nice. She's
bored, yes, you would think so, but no. Strangely into it. Onwards, Darcy. Verdict, please.
And I was expecting great things. I really was. I was expecting great things. And then I opened the lid, and there it was. So what I got, in fact, from the Dutch oven and 2 weeks of caring for a sourdough starter and 7 hours of proofing and listening to Titli Nihan was a sourdough bun. Definitely wasn't a loaf. It was somewhere between a bun and a roll. Definitely not a loaf. No big holes that you love in your sourdough bread. Crust was nice. I had some. Underwhelming, disappointing. The picture looks nice, I'll put it up there. So I'm going to go at it again, and I promise you I will not talk about it. Is that fair enough? I'm going at it again, I'm going to try different flour. I won't talk to you about it until it's done. Okay, but that's just to bring you up to date on that, because I know one person was interested down in West Cork. So there you go.
So now we have it, a little overrated, slightly disappointing. Possibly an existential metaphor at work here, or maybe not. And staying with matters existential, here's Áine Lawler and political correspondent Paul Cunningham on government formation on Tuesday's News at One.
We do know that the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party is slated to have a meeting tomorrow. So if the document is agreed by Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar, then the parliamentary parties would be the next stage. They'd have to sign off on it. And then the document, as passed by the parliamentary party, would go on to the Social Democrats, Labour and the Green Party. And that's when the rubber really hits the road, when those three parties have to decide one way or the other if they're going to be part of coalition talks or if they're going to refuse.
I've already misquoted O'Casey on the programme, but this is beginning to feel a bit like waiting for Godot, isn't it?
Well, I think we're hitting endgame now, Anya. I can't see how there's going to be too many more delays. Boom, boom.
At least
you picked up on it. So I think we're really going to get into it now.
Ho ho, Beckettian one-upmanship. Further proof, if it was needed, that the newsroom have completely lost the run of themselves. But in truth, political wrangling on the airwaves this year, business as usual of it all. Well, one might get a little misty-eyed. Back in a bit. Welcome back. We know that grocery shopping has gone through the roof, but what has also increased is our online consumption. On Thursday's News at 1, Cian McCormack reported on what we were putting in our virtual baskets.
Everything from cosmetics to beauty products, I'll give you a list. Gardening products, books, pet food, sports equipment, electrical goods, self-assembly furniture, garden furniture, slides and swings, and of course, toys to keep children occupied.
And it may well be our post men and women who are getting that lipstick through the letterbox and onto your mat. Cian spoke to a postman, Joe Sheridan, who's worked the same route in Newport, County Mayo, for 20 years.
The job is busier, the roads are quieter, and I cover approximately 100 kilometres a day of a delivery. It's one of the most scenic deliveries, I would say, anywhere in the country. I do a lot of the inlets down along the west coast, going in and out into Clube, and I'm one of the few postmen, I would say, in Ireland that I deliver to an island. I drive out on my van when the tide is out. Rossbarna Island is the name of the island. I would call now, even maybe if I hadn't post, to some very isolated or vulnerable people in the community. I would know elderly people who have maybe no family or nobody to call to them or look after them. So I would make it my business maybe just to call and check on those as I'm passing. And they also have my phone number, so they could ring me in the morning, and some do that.
What has changed over the past number of weeks? You mentioned traffic. Anything else?
It's much quieter. So I have two rural schools, and to pass those at this time of the year and see the schoolyards empty and quiet, it's a very strange feeling. Normally, as I'd be delivering, you would hear kids out playing or screeching and the natural sounds of the country. I don't hear that at all now, and I find that strange. You seem to hear bird song way clearer and way louder and more of it now. You probably are getting closer to nature and listening to the sounds of nature way more. But in rural Ireland, you will hear the tractor or the dog or the cattle or horses or whatever. You'd hear them more now and seem to hear them oftener.
Mayo postman Joe Sheridan on the News at 1. Drive Time have been asking listeners to record short pieces about what they encounter within their 2 kilometre radius. Here's Bernard O'Keefe from Kildare.
This evening I'm walking in a place called Donnelly's Hollow in County Kildare. It's called Donnelly's Hollow after the bare knuckle boxing champion Dan Donnelly, who back in 1815 beat the English champion George Cooper in a gruelling 11-round fight. It's said that it was watched by 20,000 people, and I always like to imagine the roars and shouts of the crowd around the hollow whenever I walk through this lovely place. He went on to win fights in England, and it was said that he was knighted by the Prince Regent, who said to him, "I'm glad to meet the best man in Ireland," to which Dan Donnelly said, "I'm not that, Your Majesty, but I am the best man in England." He died penniless in 1820, and there was riots in Dublin when his body was robbed by grave robbers. They got the body back, and up to a few years ago, one of his arms, mummified, was in a local pub here in Kildare. In a time when Ireland was suffering, Dan Donnelly lifted the whole nation. And God knows these days we could do with a Dan Donnelly now.
Kildare, that was Bernard O'Keefe as heard on Drive Time. Well, from mummified arms and bare knuckle fighters to goddamn superstars in Dublin's Dalkey. Author Denise Deegan told Ryan Tuberty who she bumped into when she went out for a walk.
It was Easter Sunday and it was about 8 o'clock in the evening. I had been busy all day and I really hadn't taken my head up, and I suddenly realised I hadn't called my mum. And which is terrible, not calling your mum on Easter Sunday, especially as she's been in sort of on lockdown for about 5 weeks. Mm. So I took out the phone and was sort of vaguely aware of people coming towards me, and I didn't pay any attention. I just made sure I was 2 metres, called my mum, and she's not great on the phone. Like, she tends to hold it away from her face, so you kind of have to speak loudly to her. And because she's been so locked up and kind of isolated, I wanted to sound sort of cheerful.
Yeah.
And so I sort of did a big, huge, like, hello. And then I get all these hellos back, and I kind of look up, and then I realise, oh my God, it's Matt Damon. And I'm like, oh no, 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 I'm talking to my mum. And I'm pointing at the phone, like, because I just didn't want them to think I was, you know, one of those people who just kind of goes, oh, hi, you know, just because you're famous. And I was like, then I came across as rude, because I was kind of like, well, why would I say hello to you, kind of thing. And I was like, oh, scrambling for sanity. But he was just so nice. He was sort of big Matt Damon smile, and I just sort of scooted off like a bullet. I was mortified. He just seemed like a really nice, normal guy who just seemed to be really relaxed and chilled, and actually just, I'd say, happy to be, you know, stepping down from the pressure of life for a while.
I'd say so too, and no paparazzi, just random radio shows trying to encourage people to tell us what he looks like or where he is.
Will you do the Late Late Show? Come on, do the Late Late Show, come on. Do, 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 do. Here, Maddie, Maddie, Maddie. Shh, come on. But all roads lead to the Damon, because he cropped up again on Arena. Sean and crew were reviewing two older films about pandemics. Contagion from 2011, which starred, yes, you've guessed it, our pal, our bestie, Matt, call me. And Outbreak from 1995, starring Dustin Hoffman. Paul Whittington compared the two.
I kind of worry about films like this. Do they say much to us about our current situation, or in fact, could they just panic us even further if we're feeling panic stricken at the moment?
Well, I think this is such a silly film, Sean, that I don't think it would panic anybody. At one point, Dustin Hoffman rises to his full height and utters the immortal words, many people are dying and are going to continue to die unless we find this monkey. So it's a very silly film. It's a very typical 90s sort of schlock disaster movie, like Independence Day. You can hear all the overacting. They're all shouting at each other. So this one I did not find unsettling whatsoever. However, Contagion, which is not a good film, I would say, is unsettling because it's very close to the mark.
All right, well, we'll go a little bit further into that. Why is it so close to the mark and Outbreak so far away from the mark in your mind?
Well, Outbreak, certainly, to begin with, Outbreak is kind of about an Ebola-like epidemic, but the science is deeply silly in the sense that you see this map of America and, like, day one there's 10 cases, day two there's 2,000, day three, like, it takes 3 days to wipe out everybody. Contagion is more about something similar to what we are going through. There's even a bat in it. The bat is the baddie. And it as I say, it's not a very good film. I remember, if I may take the liberty of quoting myself, Sean, my own review from the time, I said in 2011, I said, pandemic should be scary, but this one's merely dreary and much funnier than a plague has any right to be. But it's not funny watching it now, because for all its shortcomings, it really gets so much right in terms of, you know, social distancing, societal problems. It's eerie how good the science was on it, really.
Ooh, Contagion, definitely not watching that then. Sorry, Matt. An ongoing feature of our new lives is the rise and rise of birdsong. Or maybe we've just slowed down enough to hear it better. But nevertheless, the Dawn Chorus has been cancelled this year. But that wasn't stopping the Mooney Show. Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland joined Derek, who is being shunned by the Blue Tits.
Now, right now, my Blue Tits have not come back yet, Niall. I did see them prospecting in early February. I saw them going into the box and coming out, but they haven't started to nest yet. Why?
Well, they can be very fickle little creatures. And as you said, in February, that's when they often go and decide where they want to nest. They go around testing different sites. And although it'll be a few weeks or even months before they actually get down to the business of building the nest and laying the eggs, they've already fixed in their mind what the best likely locations are. So it could be, unfortunately, they found somewhere they like better. There's no accounting for taste.
No.
Yeah, there's no accounting for taste. But having said that, it's not too late. There's still lots of blue tits haven't started nesting yet. So there's every chance they still could. And when they start, it's usually quite quick. They can build those nests very very rapidly, and then the eggs are laid before you know it, and then they're being incubated, then you have little chicks very quickly. So once they start, they really do it very rapidly. So I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
And Derek was interested in parenting, gender roles, and distribution of labour in the blue tit family.
Actually, I want to go back to my blue tits. I don't want to be too unkind to the male, because I know the female, when she lays the eggs, and she lays one each day until the full clutch is laid, and that can be anything up to 16 eggs, depending on how productive she is in that year and how much food she gets. But she then starts incubating when the last egg is laid. But he does feed her during that period, doesn't he?
He does. He's very attentive. And it's lovely when you especially see it on a nest camera, because there's a hidden world to these birds' lives that we're only able to see in the last few years. You'll see the female particularly turning over the eggs, making sure that they all get evenly incubated. And all the time the male is coming and giving her food. And he's also keeping watch for danger. So sometimes you can hear him somewhere else in the garden keeping a watch out for maybe a cat or a squirrel or something like that that might pose a threat. And he's giving these little cheeps, these little high-pitched calls that you barely notice, but they're signals to the female to keep a low profile, keep the head down, don't make any noise at the moment. And when the chicks hatch out too, sometimes they'll respond to that as well. They'll be told basically by their parents to shut up, and they will. So it's quite interesting to see that, because obviously chicks in the nest, they're competing with each other for food. There's all this cheeping and hollering, wanting the parents to feed them, which can be dangerous. So some species, the birds have learned to be quiet when their parents tell them to. So I'm sure there's a few parents at home at the moment who wish they had similar skills.
Quiet now, or you'll get eaten. But if you've ever wanted to know what a blue tit looked like to another blue tit, well, Niall Hatch is the man with the answer.
It's interesting with blue tits as well, because although to our eyes the male and the female look exactly the same pretty much, to each other they look very different. Male blue tits have a big patch of ultraviolet coloration on the backs of their heads, which the females lack. Now, we humans, our eyes are not capable of seeing ultraviolet. It's a completely invisible part of the spectrum to us. But to birds, it's a colour just like any other, just like red, green or blue. We just can't even conceive of what it must look like. So it's a mystery colour. And in the same way that, let's say, blue and yellow would mix together to make green, so blue and ultraviolet must mix together to make yet another colour that we can't even imagine. So blue tits probably look quite different to the way we actually expect if you look at them through another blue tit's eyes.
Ooh, little ultraviolet blue tit ravers. That was Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland on Mooney Goes Wild. Last Saturday, we all shone a light skywards to show global solidarity and hope. So let's finish this week's playback with a specially commissioned poem to mark that occasion, written by Moya Cannon and read by Saoirse Ronan.
Light is what days are made of. It pulls the daffodil up out of dark earth, prompts the eagle and the stub-tailed wren to nest, and draws the humpback whale north with its song. Stones warm on the morning seashore know it. Our sun is so much older than them. Such tempests of grief it has scanned. Yet light, like love, eternally draws us on.